OWC Radio, episode number 22, an interview conversation with Gary Noble. Hey guys, Tim Robertson here, OWC Radio, up to episode number 22. I know we didn't have an episode last week. I apologize for that. The last 3 weeks has been kind of crazy scheduling-wise for me. And it really kind of... OWC Radio took the hit for that, unfortunately. I was in Los Angeles, and then I was in New York, and then I was back in Los Angeles. But it looks like my traveling is done for a while, which is good timing because the bad weather is starting to set in here in Michigan, where I'm at. And so... I really did want to get an episode out last week. There was just no opportunity to do so, unfortunately. But I am back with, I think, a great episode. I have a conversation with Gary Noble. He is, number one, it's a great guy. Number two, he's a Grammy Award-winning audio mixing engineer. And I haven't had anybody from that background on OWC Radio before, so I got to learn a lot. I've always kind of... looked at myself as an audiophile. When it comes to good quality audio, I'm kind of a snob when it comes to music and soundtracks and the music and movies. I always pay attention to it. I've got some very nice headphones that when I want to enjoy music, I can. And so for me, talking to an audio engineer was very appealing because it was an actual job that had I known about an audio engineer when I was 16, 17 years old, I probably would be doing that right now because I really like the process. That being said, though, Gary's a great guy, and I think you guys will enjoy this interview. But before we get to that, a couple things. Last time I did a show, I was still waiting for my iPhone 6 Plus. Well, the good news is I got it. It's sitting right here next to me, as a matter of fact. I had to visit an Apple store before I ordered it because I wanted to hold it to make sure that it was the right choice. Now that I've actually got the iPhone 6 Plus and I've been using it for, 5 days now, I love it. It's perfect. But I'll be the first to admit, it's not for everyone. It's way too big, for instance, for my wife. This will be the first iPhone that... my wife's not so enamored with technology and the new stuff like I am. And so when I buy a new iPhone, she generally gets the one that I'm giving up. And it's about a year old at that point. So when I went from the 4 to the 4S, she got my 4. When I went from the 4S to the 5S, you get how I'm going. So this time around, I went from a 5S to the 6 Plus. She has the 5S. And she's already told me after holding the 6 Plus that she doesn't want this iPhone. So next year when it's time to upgrade again, she's not going to get the 6 Plus. But to be honest, I don't know what Apple could really offer on the 6 Plus that I don't already have. So, they're going to have to come out with something truly spectacular for me to come off my 6 Plus. Maybe it's the sapphire screen. If the entire screen was sapphire instead of the glass, maybe that'll do it for me. But right now, I'm totally in love with the 6 Plus. I think it's a great phone. It takes great video and photos, which was a huge selling point for me. It really is. I take photos all the time of the kids, and you guys are probably the same way. It's the one feature of the iPhone that I don't think gets enough attention, or any cell phone, not just the iPhone, Android devices, Windows phones, Blackberries, like anybody's using a Blackberry. We're constantly taking pictures with these things, and the 6 Plus takes just unbelievably great pictures. So that was a big selling point for me. Number two was the battery life. Now, as much as I really liked my 5S, and I did, and I still do, the one complaint I've had about the 5S was the battery life. Hasn't been very good at all. Now, thankfully, I'm usually in a place where it's charging or it's plugged in. I'm in the car, I'm at home, I'm in the office, whatever. It's usually, I'm in an area where I can plug it in. But because of all the traveling I've been doing lately, I really, really noticed the battery drain. It helps when you're on an airplane to put it in airplane mode because the radio is built into it, the Bluetooth, the Wi-Fi, none of that is running. So that saves and conserves battery life. I was turning down the brightness quite a bit just to squeak out another hour or two before I can get back to the hotel and charge the battery. But yeah, it wasn't very good. I haven't had the opportunity to put the iPhone 6 Plus through the battery lasting tests, I guess. So I can't really speak to that, but all the reports that I read and Apple's published figures on the battery life looks really good. So I'm hopefully going to be very satisfied with that aspect of it. And of course, the other big feature for me was the big screen. I've wanted a bigger screened iPhone since the very first iPhone, when it was a 3.5-inch screen. This is a big screen. It really, really is. Now, I've got pretty big hands, so I can reach the top of the screen. I don't have to use that. You push, or I guess you tap the home button and it shrinks the screen a little bit so you can reach the top. I don't have to do that, so that's good. So I can still operate this phone with one hand, but it is a big phone. And like I said, I'll be the first to admit it's not for everyone. So if you're still on the fence, if you're on an older iPhone and you're not sure if you want the 6 or the 6 Plus, do what I did. Go to an Apple store, go to whoever sells iPhones in your area and has them on display, and simply play with both of them and see which one's going to work best for you. Because it's not for everybody. So I'm happy to have my my brand spanking new iPhone 6 here. And I'm also happy to talk about a couple products that OWC just came out with. And I think these are two fantastic products that you're going to be very interested in. The first one, now, we got a lot of very positive press from the Thunder Bay 4. We came out with a new product. That's the Thunder Bay 4 Mini. Now, yes, it is physically smaller than the larger Thunder Bay 4. But this is designed to use with 4 2.5-inch drives. So, obviously, the first thing that comes to my mind is SSD. Now imagine a high-speed RAID with 4 SSDs in it. That's that's fast. And because if you go with the SSD options, it's going to be nearly silent. Combine that with SoftRAID 5. It's the first ever SoftRAID 5 for the Mac, and it's available with the Thunder Bay 4 Mini RAID 5 edition. It's even better. This is an awesome box. If you're looking for serious storage that you can go with near silent operation, with not only the speed that you could expect from a RAID, but SSD as well, you're going to be very, very happy with the Thunder Bay 4 Mini. It really is a perfect one, perfect device if you're a road warrior, if say Gary, for instance, that we have later on the show, is going to do a live recording somewhere and he needs that speed and he needs that flexibility and portability, the Thunder Bay 4 Mini would be perfect for someone like Gary. And if you're on the road doing video productions, it would be perfect for you as well. Or even if you're not on the road, you just want a much smaller footprint box on your desk that's a RAID that could take advantage of SSD, this is the perfect solution, I think, in my opinion, for you. So make sure you're going to MacSales.com and look at the Thunder Bay 4 Mini. The next product that I do absolutely have to talk about is something that I'm going to be buying myself. A couple days ago, as I record this episode of OWC Radio, OWC announces pre-order availability for the OWC Thunderbolt 2 dock. Yep, a Thunderbolt 2 dock, supporting connectivity for up to 78 devices. Now, this thing's going to sell good for OWC for a reason. This is a device that a lot of people have been clamoring for, including me. But it's not just a box that we slap together and some cheap plastic and throw on the desk with inexpensive controllers. No, this is a very great product. It looks beautiful. You've got to go to MacSales.com and take a look at this. This is a box that you're going to want on your desktop. It's beautiful. I think it's one of these products. As soon as I saw it, I had to have it. And unfortunately, it hasn't been released yet, so I don't have one. I'm dying to get my hands on one. It's going to solve a lot of problems for me. Now, what is included with the OWC Thunderbolt 2 dock? Well, how about two Thunderbolt 2 ports, five USB 3 ports, one FireWire 800 port, one gigabit Ethernet port, one HDMI, one audio input, one audio output. It's exactly what I've been waiting for. It's amazing. And I cannot wait to spend my money to buy one because this is exactly what, as a Mac user, I need this. I really do. I'm so sick of reaching behind my machine all the time to swap cables out of different ports. I'm over that. And this box is going to fix that for me. I'm really interested in running multiple displays as well. But again, with one Thunderbolt on my current Mac, swapping it out with an external hard drive, it's not fun at all. And this is going to be a perfect solution for that. So I'm really looking forward for this to ship because I want one. It's the OWC Thunderbolt 2 dock. You can connect up to 78 devices with this. Can you imagine that? If you have to connect 78 devices, I want to see your setup. Send me a picture of that because that would look awesome. you could run two 27-inch cinema displays with this, or even one 4K display and one standard definition display. Dual-sided mounted high-powered USB ports are perfect for charging and syncing iPhone, iPad. You know, I've got three iPads sitting here, and that's just iPads. I'm not even talking about my iPhones yet. I still own every single iPhone that I purchased, every one of them. And I still have to charge and sync all of them. The kids use the older ones as kind of a glorified iPod Touch. They don't have SIM cards in them. But I still have to charge them. I still want to sync and put new games on it for them. My wife, she has my iPhone 5S. Now, she usually keeps that charging in the kitchen. But I still want to put new apps on there. And I do want to back it up to the main computer. So I have to have an open port for that. So this is going to be great with five USB ports on it. This is awesome. So if you have need, and let's be honest, you probably do. If you have need for expansion, this is going to be fast. It looks beautiful on your desk. And it's going to be easy to plug and unplug things into it, which is, I don't know why Apple does it still insists on putting every port on the back. I've got a 27-inch iMac. It's not easy to stand there and reach behind there, unplugging this cable and plugging that one in. I want a dock that has all the ports that I need. And this is going to be it for me. I know without even touching it yet. It's beautiful. It's fast. And it's convenient. And those are things that I'm looking for. So if you're interested, go up to MacSales.com and take a look at the OWC Thunderbolt 2 dock. With that, I'm going to wrap up this segment of OWC Radio 2.0. It's a day before Thanksgiving as I record this here in the United States. And I do want to send out a happy greetings to everyone. Please be safe on the roads if you're up in the Northeast. I know that they're about to get hit by a pretty big storm. And it's the busiest time of the year for travel. So please be safe. Have a great Thanksgiving. And make sure you acknowledge all the things you have to be thankful for this year. I know I've got a lot. And this is the year that I started working for OWC, and I'm very thankful for that. It's a company that I really, really like, and it's an honor for me to work here. And I hope that you guys have a lot to be thankful for, because in this life, we could kind of take things for granted. And in this fast-paced world that we live in now, where everything's a 24-hour news cycle and everyone's here and everyone's there and all this communication's coming in and all these different forms of entertainment that you can partake in, sometimes we need to stop and just be thankful for the things that we have in our life, for the people that are still with us, or remembering those that we've lost. So have a fantastic Thanksgiving, and I will see you next week. And we've got an interview lined up next week. I'm looking forward to that. And I hope you enjoy this interview with Gary Noble coming up right now. And we are back here on OWC Radio 2.0, episode number 22. And I've got a special guest. As you guys know, I've been doing conversations with people. I don't really like calling them interviews. I like to call them conversations. And this time, my conversation is with a Grammy Award-winning audio mixing engineer who describes himself as a sonic alchemist that molds and sculpts sounds, then combines them to create emotion. That's awesome. Gary Noble, welcome to OWC Radio.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me. That's the description that was given to me by a client and now a good friend. That's what he called me.
I think it's awesome.
He said, I'm a magician. I'm like a sonic alchemist. And I was like, wow, I like that.
So how long have you been a sonic alchemist?
Over 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been doing this for quite a while. I got into music. I've always loved music. I remember 5 years old operating my dad's stereo system, got in trouble for it. He told me never to touch it. I got caught once or twice. I got in trouble, but I never stopped. I never damaged anything. I knew how to work it, you know, whether it was the tapes or the vinyl or whatever it was. I knew how to do it. Later on, around 15, I started DJing. And then I went to a studio once with a good friend of mine. And when I walked in, I knew that's where.
That was it. That was your calling.
Yep, and I stayed there all night, and at the end of the night, I walked over to the engineer. We later became friends, and said to him that I would really like to learn how to be an engineer, how to work the equipment, and, you know, learn all about music as much as I can and stuff like that. And then he told me, if you're serious, go to IAR, Institute of Audio Research, which at the time was one of the few schools. This is in the... It's on 10th Street in the village, like a few blocks from NYU.
Gotcha.
He said, go there, do the program, the recording program, and when you graduate, when you finish, come and see me, and then we'll talk.
And that's what you did?
And that's what I did. So when I did it, he told me that, he told that to like 20 other people, and none of them did it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, when you're in the environment, it seems like a really cool thing, and people get excited about it, and then they get home and, oh, let's play Atari or something, you know?
Right.
And he said I was a, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the one who does it, who takes the advice, and then comes back with a piece of paper in his hand saying, see, I did exactly what you said, and here I am.
Came back waving it like, hey, I'm ready.
Yeah, so that told him you were serious.
Yeah, and then he was like, all right, come on, let's go. And that's where it started, and I never looked back.
Who was your biggest influence?
Wow, so many. So many. I was listening to so many people, you know, from Michael Jackson, Quincy Jones, Bruce Sweden. The guy who got me started was a guy by the name of Franklin Grant. A good guy. He was my neighbor. He lived on my block when I moved to that area, he was already on the block, and I met him one day, and we started talking, and it just took off from there. And there's so many people. I was just into music. Growing up, my parents used to listen to everything from Bob Marley to Marvin Gaye to Patti Page, Al Green, you know, Stylistics. You name it. So, Thelonious Monk, like, I was listening to, like, all types of music, and I used to sit and analyze records and just sit and listen, like, how did they get that to sound like that? At the time, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just listening to it and trying to figure out.
All the different levels of the sound.
In my, Right. I was basically training myself without knowing what I was doing. And I used to experiment. I had, when I became a DJ, I had a setup in my house where I had a Studio Revox, reel to reel. I had Cell Sync on it, had a dual cassette deck, had an MXR 3-second delay unit that I used to do to create loops. And I would layer stuff and scratch over it and this and that, blah, blah, blah. I had my friends come in and sing and do stuff. And I was like experimenting before I even actually got into the studio and figuring out different things work. I used the crossovers for my DJ system to filter stuff. I was just, you know, using the EQs and I, you know, a lot of stuff, trial and error, I figured out. And
well, that's how you learn, though.
Yeah, yeah. So my, without actually knowing what I was doing, I was actually training my ears to recognize things and figuring out what works and, you know, the difference between the delays and the reverbs and the choruses and flanging. Flanging, I used to do back then as a DJ, I used to do with two records.
Oh, really?
Like, I played two records of the same song together, and then you slightly delay one, just a couple of milliseconds, then you get that whooshing sound that flanging does.
That's awesome.
And that's original, right, the original flanging, that's how it was done. They put their finger on the tape flange. They actually put their finger on the tape flange, and that's how they got the, how they got the flanging. Now, you know, we use it with plugins and all that stuff.
You know, a lot of people, after they've done something for a long time, they tend to lose their passions for it. It's just a job. Right. But I'm listening to you talking about your past, and I don't think you've lost your passion at all. In fact, you sound very passionate about this.
No, I didn't. That's what a lot of people find surprising about. Like, I spoke to someone a few months ago that I hadn't seen in years, and they asked me how I was and, you know, how am I doing, and I said, I'm doing good. And I'm the thing. They say, you're still engineering? I'm like, yes. And they looked at me like, you're still engineering? Like, most people I know, they quit a long time ago. This and that. I said, nah, but, you know, this is you know, my passion. This is my life's passion. This is what I'm about. I felt like I was made for this. Like, this is, you know, to me, the music is like breathing. It's like, I have to do it.
That's who you are. It's part of you.
Yeah, exactly. That's who I am. So,
what kind of, as an engineer, what is your, how do you look at musicians? I mean, what is that relationship? Do you help them craft what they're doing?
I have the utmost admiration and respect for them, because I learned early in my career the dedication and the focus and the sacrifice it takes to be a great musician. It takes a lot, because, you know, it's hours of practice every day. If you really want to, it's like with anything, if you really want to be good at it, you have to dedicate yourself to it. You have to put in the time and have an open mind and be willing to learn. And, you know, a lot of people now I've seen, they don't like to do that. They don't like to what we call pay dues. They decide, okay, today I'm going to do this. I want to be this, and they expect it to happen in like 6 months. And they don't realize that it takes years to get to that level where you can be, like, you know, professionally proficient in it.
Do you think that's the American Idol influence on American culture?
Yeah, that might be part of it, because on TV, it makes it seem like you can be an overnight success without really doing anything.
And right.
It doesn't work like that in real life.
And I think that's true, though, not just musicians. It's true with actors and comedy and,
Yep, in all walks of life. Whether you do anything, whatever profession it is, it's going to take time to be really, really good at it. It's not going to just, you're not going to just wake up today and say, okay, I want to be a singer. And then 6 months down the road, you have a hit song on the radio. It doesn't work like that. I've known people who, it took them 7, 8, 9 years before they even got a hit song on the radio.
Right.
And that's 7, 8, 9 years of, excuse me, consistently working at their craft and consistently trying and putting out records and this and that till they finally broke through.
You know, it's funny, people say it's an overnight success, but what they don't realize is for every overnight success, there's, you know, a decade of getting to that point. So exactly. For that person, they're not an overnight success. They paid their dues. Right. I'll give you the prime example. Mark Maron has a very popular podcast called WTF. He's a comedian. And he's been on the road for like 30 years doing his craft. And all of a sudden, his podcast explodes. That helps his stand-up comedy act, which leads him to getting a TV show now. And people say, look, he's like an overnight success. Are you kidding me? The guy was doing it for 30 years.
Exactly. And that's the thing. The media is part of the reasons, too, why people see that. Because just because you just heard about someone today doesn't mean that they weren't around before. That's the thing. That's the perception that happens, and it makes it seem like it happened, but it doesn't happen like that. They've been working behind the scenes. They've been working on their craft for many, many years.
And for everybody who makes it big,
singer, actor, producer, whatever it is, they've all been working on their craft for many years.
And for those who do make it big, no matter what it is, whether it's a studio engineer, an actor, a comedian, it doesn't matter. For everyone who makes it big, there's 100 people who are never going to make it big.
Right. Exactly, you know? and that's a fact of life, and you have to be willing to deal with that. And that's what with that. Personally, what I did with that was okay. So I might not ever make it as one of the big time engineers, but I'm going to give it my best shot. I'm going to try even harder because of that reason.
Right, you're going to strive for it.
I'm going to strive for it.
So, what was the first big project you worked on?
The one
that you thought, I can't believe I'm working on this project.
Oh, that would be the Fugees.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
The first, we worked with them, the Sporks, on Fuji Lock.
Man, I haven't heard about the Fugees in forever.
Yeah. I just recently did some stuff for, Lauren. She's got they're doing she did a live performance at Brooklyn Bowl in the summer, and they taped it and everything, and I think it's actually on now on pay-per-view.
Awesome.
Yeah, and they asked me to mix the audio. They recorded the audio and they asked me to mix it and make it sound good. Yeah, make it sound good. Make it sound professional.
You know, I can't tell you how many live albums I've bought, and for every 10 live albums, mm-hmm. one sounds good. The rest sounds, you know.
Yeah, that's the complaint from a lot of people. And that's one of the reasons why I was brought in to help out with that.
Yeah, I was flipping through the channels maybe a month or two ago, and they had and it was from like 2010 maybe, but it was Billy Ocean playing on VH1. It was a live concert. Mm-hmm. And the audio quality was just fantastic. And I thought, man, somebody spent a lot of time. Because you know, in a live mm-hmm. event, it's not a studio. It's, you know, you can't control what it's going to sound like. But whoever had to do that mix afterwards, I was thinking, that must have just taken weeks and weeks to do.
Yeah, it takes a long time because it's not one song. It's a two-hour show.
Right.
And it's like 20 songs, and you have to go through and fine-tune each and every one of them.
And they're talking between, and...
Talking, and there's leakage, you know, like you solo an instrument, and you hear the background singers on it.
Right.
It's like, there's so many things you have to do, and it's like a balancing act. You have to figure out how to balance it so that even though there's leakage, it works for you. And that in itself is hard.
Now, technology... Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was saying that in the studio, it's a more controlled environment. Everything is isolated and stuff like that. So it's easier to, like, if you want to make an adjustment on something, you can just adjust it without having to worry about anything else. In a live environment, it's different.
Well, which one do you prefer?
The studio.
Yeah. Well, obviously, it's easier, but, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm not going to lie, I love the energy of the live performance. So sometimes I do live sound, too, because I really love that immediacy and, you know, it keeps you on your toes. The analogy I would make is that working in the studio is like riding a well-trained horse.
Right.
And then working in live is like writing a wild book.
That's an apt analogy. Yeah.
You never know what's coming and you have to hold on for dear life.
Now, obviously, OWC is a technology company, and what you do is very involved in technology, and it's changed dramatically since you got your start. How do you stay on top of that? How do you? I mean, there's a lot of people now that you don't have to go to these giant studios to get the sound that you want. You could do it on a laptop. How do you educate yourself from where you started to where you are now? And is that a continuous process?
Yes. What I did was initially, when I saw that it was shifting, I started to get into digital recording and mixing. And initially, what we did, we would... Well, when I first, I've been around, I remember when Pro Tools was called Sound Tools.
Yeah,
I didn't like the sound of it. I liked the features, the convenience, and how you could edit and stuff, but I didn't like the sound of it. And I actually didn't purchase Pro Tools for myself until it became HD. Because that's when the sound quality, to me, first became good enough to say, okay, now I can actually... use this as more than just a tape machine, just for editing. Because before that, I would just use it to do edits and stuff, and then I'll fed it into the SSL console or the Neve console. SSL is like a standard in almost every studio.
Right.
So we use the SSL, 4K, you know, J, K, E. I use the E, the G+, the J, or the K for mixing. And on the Neve, it was mainly the VR, the Neve VR. So we would feed the output, the converters from the Pro Tools onto the board, and then I would use the board and all this outboard and stuff and do the mixes. Now I'm actually mixing completely in the box, or sometimes in the box along with Summon.
Okay.
Which would be, you know, analog Summon or whatever. But if you told me 10 years ago that I would be mixing on a laptop, I would laugh.
Really?
Laugh you out of the room.
It's been that big of a change.
Yeah, it's been that big of a change. And I'm not going to lie, in the beginning, I was a diehard analog guy. If it wasn't on 2-inch, if I wasn't in a room with the big console and the tons of outboard and a 2-inch machine and a 1/2-inch machine, I wasn't going to do it. But I saw that it was shifting, and I said, well, basically, you're going to have to decide. Are you going to be a dinosaur, or are you going to evolve?
Yeah.
I said, listen, I'm going to evolve because I love music too much. I'm going to stay with it. And I learned. So when I decided to start dabbling in the digital recording thing, I actually started out with Digital Performer. Because I was using Performer along with clients of mine to compose stuff, to put stuff together. But we're just MIDI. Then I went to a seminar, a Motu seminar, and they showed this new product that was coming out, Digital Performer. And what grabbed me even more so than the features was the sound of it. I said it actually sounded like, you know, it sounded good. Like, okay, I could use this. So I bought it and taught myself how to use it and everything. Because when I went to IR, everything was analog. There was no digital anything. They spoke about it, but there was not actually no digital. There was no Pro Tools, there was none of that to actually work on. The computers that we used in the studio was to do the automation.
Gotcha.
And for MIDI programming and stuff like that.
But was it the audio quality or the tools weren't there?
The quality wasn't there.
Gotcha.
And the tools, they were just developing the tools for digital. Like it was in the basic, you know, it was the basic... They were just basic, like, 2-track editors and stuff like that.
What I've noticed when I look at some of the higher-end audio engineer tools is... I think that what they've done is recreated the analog consoles in digital form.
Yes. Yes, they have. And funny you should mention that. A friend of mine, a fellow engineer of mine, who's also a good friend, said to me once that he's always amazed that when he listens to stuff that I do, he knows I'm mixing in a box, so he's seen me do it a couple of times, that I'm able to make it sound like it's on tape. And he's always like, how can you do that? I said, well, because I have a the internal memory. I have a reference. I mean, I worked with tapes for so many years. I know what it's supposed to sound like.
Yeah, that's muscle memory.
Yeah, so I know how to get the sound. I know, I figured out. It took me a while to figure out. You would not want to hear the first mix I ever did in Pro Tools in the box. I would not play it for anybody. I think I deleted every copy off that I had.
Yeah, but I mean, you got to start somewhere, though, you know?
Right. I had to relearn how to work digital. Like, for a lot, for instance, I try to, you know, tell all my clients, and whenever I go and I work with people ask me questions with digital, 0 dB digital and 0 dB analog is two different things. And, you know, I have to explain to them, 0 dB analog is actually, depending on your converter, it's actually minus 18 or minus 16 digital. That's a zero. It's not zero. 0 dB digital is like plus 18 analog. So you would be slamming, the meters would be pinned all the time in analog. So I tell them, you work 24-bit, whatever sample rate you choose. Like for me, I work at 96 because I deal with a lot of live instrumentation and vocals and stuff, and it just sounds better to me. Transients come through more, and it just sounds more analog to me. So that's how I work. But I said, if you're doing mostly sample-based stuff, you're using a lot of loops and stuff like that, you can work at 44 or 48, and it's fine. Because I've done mixes at that sample rate, a lot of them, and they came out sounding great. But when I'm working with clients that we do, like I just finished doing a project that we recorded in London at the Rack Studios, where it was all live. I had so much fun because I was dealing with musicians, and we were recording to Pro Tools, but we didn't sequence anything. Everything was completely live. All the keys, the drums, the bass, the guitars, the vocals. We used a huge live room. We partitioned off the drums.
And that's the exception now. That's not the rule, right?
Yeah, that's the exception. So when they called me and asked me if I'd be willing to come to London, and they told me what they were trying to do, I was like, yes, okay, I'll be there.
That's old school.
You know what I mean? So yeah. I went and I went twice, actually. We spent a week each time, and we were just in the studio just working, and we had so much fun. The day before, they had rehearsed a song, but the day before we were in the studio, I went with them to the rehearsal hall, and we went over the songs that we would be recording and make sure that everything was exactly how we wanted it. Then we went in the studio and just hit record, and that was it. We didn't use, everything was live. Even when we used the click, we had to click like at the beginning just to give them a count.
Right.
And that's it. And then that's it. And then it was just live.
That's awesome.
Just let it flow. And we had a great time. All the musicians were very on point. Great musicianship. Everybody was on point. You know.
No drama.
No drama. Everybody was communicating. Everybody throwing ideas at each other and stuff like that. You know, the way it used to be when I first started up, that's how it used to be, where it was more of a collaboration thing. Now, a lot of times we work in isolation, especially me. I'll be working on projects with many different artists, and I don't even see them.
Yeah, I was going to ask what the collaboration is like nowadays, because the workflow is so different. And
it's so different. I kind of miss that. I mean,
yeah.
The camaraderie and be the same room with people. It happens every now and then, but not.
I would think as a musician, I would want a little bit more say in what you're doing, because at the end of the day, you could completely change everything.
Yeah, you know? But you see, that's the thing. It's not up to the musician anymore. It's up to,
right.
At the end of the day, it's the labels that have the final say. They just dictate what it should be, what it should sound. That's the thing that some people, when you're an independent artist or musician, you can dictate exactly what you want, but when you're signed to a label, they actually have say. Now, some labels, if they have enough confidence in the artist or musician, they will allow them to have creative control. But if they don't, they dictate what it should sound like. And that's part of the reason why a lot of stuff sounds similar sometimes. When you listen to the radio, a lot of this stuff sounds similar.
Yeah, I wanted to
that certain format.
Right. I wanted to bring that up as an audio guy. There's two big stories over the last, I'm going to say, 5 years to me when it came to audio. One of them is very recent, and that's the audio quality and and the outrage for some people in the movie Interstellar. I don't know if you was reading about this or you're familiar with it, but there's dialogue that's completely stepped on by the music in the movie. And the
I read about it. I haven't seen the movie yet.
Yeah.
I plan to do it.
I did see the movie, and it is absolutely true. I mean, there was parts that I thought, I can't even hear what the character's saying, and it seems like this is an important part of the movie. I should hear what this character is saying, but yet the music is just stepping on the dialogue.
And the executive producer of the movie, his reply to that was, he felt when they were doing it that the feel of the scene took precedence over the dialogue, which I don't really get, because I know there should be a way where you can do it to where the effects would be very prominent, but the dialogue should still cut through. And I think they just dropped the ball on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to get someone's opinion who's in the... But here's the other story. Now, I like all kinds of music. I always have. I'm not...
Right.
Well, not so much country. That's not my thing.
Right.
But, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, I was into Run DMC, Beastie Boys, and Metallica.
Yep.
You know, that's a wide variety of different music. And sonically, I think those albums back in the day sounded better than a lot of the albums do today.
Yeah, they do.
Especially Metallica. Now, they came out with, I can't tell you the name of the album because I kind of stopped listening to them a while ago. But I was reading the story that their new album was mixed completely wrong. And I wanted to see it for myself, so I went and bought the album and listened to it. Every vocal, every guitar, every drum, every bass line, everything was basically at the same volume.
Yes,
and I thought, I'd like to talk to an engineer and get their opinion on that. How does something like that happen?
Because they're everybody's worrying about the loudness. And that's part of the loudness wars, which I don't contribute to. But I get that issue. I hate that. When I mix, and my friends always laugh at me because I said I mix in 3D. And they were like, what do you mean mixing 3D? I said, I mix in 3D because I mix with height, width, and depth.
Yep.
That's the way I was taught. That's the way I learned. That's the way I hear things, and that's the way I do it.
I'm like you. I was into car stereos for a while, and it was the staging of the music and how you install the speakers and the volume.
Same here. I was into car stereos, too, and my thing wasn't about, like, some guy, like some of my friends, your system is crap. Mine is way louder. I said, yeah,
right.
Mine is the clarity.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything.
It sounded like the...
Go ahead.
You could be sitting in the car and you could point to the different instruments. It sounded like they were on your dashboard, even though there was no speaker right there because of the staging.
Exactly. And that to me is critical. Even now, when I mix, I'm like that.
I've described myself as an audiophile since 1990. And as an audiophile, I like good songs, but I like them to sound correct. And there's a lot of times when I'm listening to a song and I think I would like this song if they spent a little bit more time making it better, and that's on the engineer. I think, you know, you can make or break a song.
That is true. But sometimes in defense of that, I'll tell you what happens to me, and it's happening more often now than before, because more and more people are dabbling with the digital recording and doing stuff themselves that they're home studio and stuff. I get a lot of sessions that are incorrectly recorded. Some of the track is distorted.
Yeah, there's only so much you can do.
Right, the noise level, and in defense of the mixing engineer, when the recordings are very poor quality, it's so much you can do to the, like when I get a song where I hit play. And I could just like, wow, this sounds good. And all I have to do is just mix. I love that. My friends laugh at me when I tell them, I say, I hate when I get a song and I spend more time fixing than mixing. And one of my clients actually saw me do this. I was in a session that they brought to me to mix. We're in the studio, SSL and everything, and I spent like 6 hours getting the track in shape just to mix, and then only spent 4 hours mixing it.
Yeah, you got to fix it before you can. Yeah.
I got to fix it. He was like totally amazed. Like, I can't believe this is the same record.
Yeah. Well, like I said, you can make or break an album. Let me ask you another question, and I don't want to take your whole day up here, but...
No, that's all right, Tim. I don't get to talk shop a lot. This is good.
And you're doing something that I've always been interested in. I've never been professionally trained. Now, obviously, I do podcasts, and I've been doing them for 10 years, so audio mixing is kind of what I do as well. But not on your level, but it's still something that I'm very interested in. I have no musical ability of my own, but I've got a very good ear for it. But what did the rise of the iPod and these cheap white earbuds do for you? Because up to that point, we were kind of expecting better sounding music. That was kind of the thing. And then we went the opposite direction with MP3s, which is very compressed.
Which I always hated.
Sure, absolutely. we went with a crappier sound, with crappier headphones, for the sake of convenience and portability. What did that do to your job? Did you see a big shift in how things were edited?
Yes. What it did for me was every time I delivered something, they wanted to sound super loud. They wanted it like pre-mastered. Because what it is, when you're walking around with your iPod, whether you're jogging, you're on the train or whatever, the sound has to be hyper-compressed and loud so that you can hear it above your environment.
Right.
Which is actually bad, because I try to explain to them. By doing that, you're doing two things. You're damaging the listener's hearing.
Yeah.
And two, they're not aware of the environment anymore, which is dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely.
I personally almost hit someone once crossing the street because they had on their headphones and they just stepped into the crosswalk.
Yeah. Yeah, you see that on the news every 6 months. Somebody walks in front of a train because they had their headphones in and they couldn't hear the train. A train.
Exactly. A train. You know how loud a train is?
I work for the railroad. I know exactly how loud they can be.
Right. So I said that they should have kept it. Because, I mean, you and I'm quite sure you did it also. When I was a kid coming up, I used to have headphones and stuff like that. And then we used to be, you know, I had the portable radio, I plug it into it, and I have it on. But it was a different, the quality was still there. It still sounded good. And you never played it so loud that you couldn't hear what was going on.
That's right.
Because you always want, my parents always warned me about it. Be careful crossing the street with your headphones on. They always used to tell me at the time, it's like, oh, come on, man. You know what I mean? But now I understand why they were saying that. But to me, the on-the-air headphones was always better because no matter how good they were, there was some leakage from outside of what was going on. And it also didn't put as much pressure on your eardrum. With the buds now, they go inside.
Yeah, I can't wear them.
Yeah, I hate them.
Well, there's a difference between listening to music in your car or when you're out for a walk or a jog and you're just kind of enjoying the music or listening to a podcast.
Right.
That's different than being at home, putting this music on, putting your good pair of headphones on. Like, I've got a pair of AKGs that they're just
AKGs
awesome.
AKGs are great, man. AKGs are great.
You know, I spent, you know, upwards of $400 for these. But, you know, there's a difference of consuming the audio. There's one that I'm just listening to listen, and then there's another time where I'm listening to consume it, to immerse myself in it.
Right.
And so to me, it was always a good separation. It's like, yeah, I don't care if it doesn't sound perfect because I'm out walking, and I still want to hear the dog that's going to come barking up behind me.
Exactly. It's like it's background music.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it's like, you know, when you're watching a movie and you have the sound bed.
Yes.
It's like that to me. So I'm walking in the background. I'm like, okay, it's my theme music. I'm going.
That's right. It's the soundtrack for this activity. Absolutely.
Right. It's not supposed to overtake everything.
That's right.
Obliterate my surroundings.
I'm with you 100% on that.
Okay.
Great. And it's good to know that an audio engineer feels that way too.
Yeah. No, we do. We definitely do feel like that. And that's part of the problem. Now they're starting to realize that the loudest wasn't a good thing, and they started to go the other way. The mastering engineers, they do it because they have to.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Is it starting to go back now? Is the good audio quality coming back?
Yes, there's been a lot of talk about it, and they're going the other way. That's the reason why iTunes uses AAC instead of MP3,
right,
because it gives a much better quality sound. A 128K AAC sounds way better than a 128K MP3.
Oh, yeah, no question.
Yeah, way, way better. And when I do MP3s for clients, when I send them, like I'm sending them a ref of the mix to email them, I do the maximum. I do 320.
Right.
I don't do anything less, because that's, anything below that for me, I can hear the difference.
I think a big part of that is everyone is on high speed now. And back in the day when half the people had modems, we had to make the files as small as possible. But we don't have to worry about that as much. You know, if you're gonna send someone a 3 megabyte file or a 10 megabyte file, at the end of the day, it really doesn't make a difference.
No, exactly.
But audio quality makes a huge difference.
And that's one of the reasons why they're starting to push all these high quality streaming services now, because they realize that almost everyone has broadband. Even my cell phone, when I'm on LTE, I actually did a speed test off the LTE versus the Wi-Fi on my cell phone, and it's the same speed.
Wow. Of course, you don't have to pay extra for the Wi-Fi.
Right, exactly. But I'm just saying, even people can listen on their phones, the Wi-Fi and whatever. So everybody has broad access to broadband now. So they figured, now we can actually open up the files more, you know, have more quality of the files. So I know it's not going to be an overnight thing, but I'm just glad that they're actually thinking of going in another direction, which is good. And the mastering engineers hate the fact that they have to slam everything to death. They don't like that. They do it because...
Right, they have to. They're told
to do it. Right.
Right, it's their job.
Right.
I said it right at the beginning. Grammy award winning. What did you win the Grammy for? What project?
Amy Winehouse.
That's awesome.
Yeah, Back to Black.
Before we wrap up here, mm-hmm. something new, and you're the guinea pig. You're the first one I'm doing this with. I way back in the day when I did the original OWC radio, I had this mm-hmm. Random questions, this or that type of thing. And I thought, I don't want to do the this or that, but I want to have three random questions that have absolutely nothing to do with your job or right. anything that we've talked about. So these are the three, and there's a website. I'm not going to give it away because any future guests, I don't want to cheat and go up there and start looking and figuring out what their answers are going to be ahead of time. So here's your three random questions. Ready for them?
Okay.
Number one, what's your favorite pudding?
Bread pudding.
Bread pudding, really?
Mm-hmm. Yep. My grandma used to make it for me all the time.
Yeah, see, now that's why it's your favorite. Because your grandma made it.
I'm going to give you a story behind it. I actually used to go to the bakery and get the fresh bread from them. Not the fresh bread, like the day old bread.
Right.
The day old bread actually works better. The day old or 2 day old bread.
Well, it doesn't dissolve in the liquid as quickly.
Right. And to get that, I would go take it back home and I would grate it for her and everything and give it to her, and then she would, you know, do her magic with it.
So it wasn't, so is it really the bread pudding, or is it the nostalgia of doing that with your grandma?
I think it's a combination of both, because yeah. it was really good. Like, to date, I haven't tasted anything, but I think that the memory of it, because, you know, she's no longer with us, you know, rest in peace. I think that the memory of it also, and that was like a really happy time in my life. I think that.
So when you have it now, yeah,
together,
it takes you back.
Yeah, it takes me back.
That's exactly. Awesome. Great, great answer to a very random question. Ready for number two?
Yes.
What was your first car?
Wow. this is crazy. You see, my first car was an old, I don't even remember what year it was. I think it was a 68 or something like that. And it was diesel.
Mm.
It was an old Mercedes that my dad got from one of his friends or something, or he bought off one of his friends for like cheap, and he fixed it up and gave it to me. It was an old Mercedes. It had rust on it, and but I loved that car. The heat didn't work.
And you're from New York, so that's a problem.
And I'm in New York, so
mm.
we had to fix the heat, and but it ran great. It was great on gas because it was diesel, and I just loved it because it was my first car I ever actually owned.
If someone offered you that exact car, in the shape it was when you got rid of it, for $500, would you buy it right now?
Yeah, I would.
Would you? Me too. Mine was a 1970 Delta 88 Oldsmobile that my dad handed
down
to
me. Oh, yeah, that's a great car. A friend of mine had one of those. Great car.
I loved it. Last random question.
Yeah.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was in construction all his life. He was called a heavy... His official title was heavy machine operator. My father was the guy that you would see going through Manhattan in the middle of the day with those huge cranes,
yeah,
with the 80-foot boom behind it, navigating down the narrow one-way street. That was my dad.
That's a lot. That's placing a lot of trust in someone to do that.
Yeah, he was very good. He was like, whenever his company needed to move the huge machines from site to site, he was the one that they always called, because he just, that was his thing. He could do that with his eyes closed.
Yeah? Is your dad still with you?
Yeah, he's still with me, but he's retired now.
So what does he think about your job? I mean, does he remember you messing with the stereo back in the day, and he could trace it right back?
Yeah, he remembers. He remembers when I used to be in the basement, and he never complained because I was always home. It kept me home and kept me off the street, so he didn't have a problem with me doing music. He actually encouraged it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what kind of encouragement did you get from your parents growing up with your choice of becoming an engineer? Or did you even have a name for what you wanted to do? It was just this vague.
Yeah, I knew what the name was, but they were a little bit ambivalent about it. Mm-hmm. They were glad that I found something that I was passionate about, but they weren't sure if it was the right choice. They wanted me to just go, why can't I just go and get like a regular job?
Well, your dad was a construction. I mean, you know, he was a blue collar, exactly. Roll up his sleeves.
Exactly. And he was like, you could come work with me type of thing. So
right.
He was a little ambivalent about it, but the fact that I was so focused on it and I wasn't out getting in trouble like a lot of other kids my age were at the time, he kind of just like, let me try it. And then he said, listen, go ahead and try it. And then if it doesn't work out, then we'll see what else we can do. But it worked out.
You know, everybody I talk to that's successful on this podcast and in life, right, the ones who are successful had very encouraging parents. To a person, I've never talked to someone that's successful and they said, my parents fought me every step of the way of doing this. Doesn't happen. So you had great parents.
That's what a lot of people don't understand, that it makes a difference. I'm not saying that you can't be successful without the support of parents or having parents at all, because there are people who didn't grow up in, you know, great households, but it does make a difference. It does make a difference when you know that there's people that have your back. Even if it's not your parents, if you have an aunt or uncle, a cousin, or a best friend, or somebody that says, listen, go do your thing, I have your back, I'll support you if you need help. Just to have someone there. You talk to somebody who grew up an orphan, or grew up in a one-parent household, or grew up where they didn't really have their parents there for them, they'll tell you like, yeah, I didn't have my parents, but I had my friend, Fred, or they had someone there that was supportive.
Yeah.
You always find that. They always had someone there that was supportive, because it makes a big difference.
We don't live in a vacuum, that's for sure.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
And the more people wake up and realize that, the better it'll be. And not to digress, but one of the good things about internet and social media is it makes people realize that we might look different, we might speak different, we might live differently, but we're a lot alike.
Oh, I'm totally with you 100% on that. Podcasting for me kind of opened it up even more so, in that I got to meet people from all over the world. I mean, one of my best friends lives now in the UK. He's never, you know, we hardly ever see each other in person, but because of social media, because of the podcasting thing, I've met people from all over the world.
Same here.
How big of a change has the internet been for your job? Because it didn't really exist in any meaningful form when you started.
It made a huge difference. I have clients from all over.
Yeah.
It's made a huge, huge difference. One of my favorite people to work with is lives in Paris. His name is Abd al-Malik. He's a spoken word author, artist, and now a actor and movie director. He just put out his own independent film, and I worked with him on two albums, and both albums won the equivalent of Grammys in France.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a great guy, and it's like that would have never happened without the internet.
Gary Noble. Never
met. Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so we would have never connected without the internet.
So Gary Noble is a Grammy Award winning audio mixing engineer. He is passionate about what he does. And I want to thank you for coming on OWC Radio this week. I had a blast talking to you.
Same here.
You know, I appreciate you accepting the invitation via Twitter. And I do want to put this out there. I am looking for more guests. I am booked up with guests through part of January at this point. But I am looking for more people to come on the show. As you could hear with Gary, it's fairly easy. I don't hit anybody with really tough questions. It's audio only. It's not video because nobody wants to see me. And it was pretty painless, wasn't it, Gary? Pretty painless?
Yeah, no, it was great. It was great talking to you. It was a great conversation. You know, you're obviously very good at it. You put your guests at ease, and it was easy talking to you, and I actually enjoyed it because, like I said, I don't get to talk shop a lot anymore. Whenever I meet someone that shows any interest in it, I tend to ramble.
No, you.
I tend to run off with the mouth a bit, but
I think people are going to enjoy this, and I do appreciate you coming on. I had a lot of fun. Thanks, Gary.
All right, no problem, Tim. Anytime. All right, thanks, and you have a great day, and happy Thanksgiving.
You too.